Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Good afternoon. This is Marcello Rolando, your host of the Reasonable Voices Talk Radio Show. As always, when I have a guest on that is involved in film and theater, I'm especially pleased. I think that's a great way, film, theater, documentaries, to really get at the truth about life, to tell you the truth. My guest today is Lucas Nieuwenbrugge.
Beautiful.
Thank you, and welcome. As
beautiful.
And Lucas, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thank you for so much for being on the show. I may not be courageous, and you're most welcome, and I may not be courageous enough to try your last name more than once more, but it's a beautiful name, and there you are. Lucas, by the way, plays Dean in the film Lazy Eye, and I got to tell you, I love the title because, of course, I have some idea of how magnificent a title that is because I have the privilege of seeing the trailer and so forth. But Lazy Eye will be released theatrically in North America in November 2016, very soon. And Lucas plays Dean, as I said. He's a graphic designer in Los Angeles who reconnects with Alex, played by Aaron Costaganis, an ex-boyfriend he hasn't seen or heard from in 15 years. However, this is no simple weekend in the country, is it, Lucas?
No, it's not. It's a pretty loaded weekend, actually, as you might imagine when you're reconnecting with someone who you haven't seen in a while.
Exactly, exactly. Especially with whom you've had a special relationship, let's put it that way.
That adds a whole new layer of complication.
And I don't want to, I especially don't want to give away, unless you want to, the twist of the title. There are plenty of twists in the film, but the title itself, I think, obviously, intentionally, knowing some of the work of the director here, and who is Tim Kirkman, by the way, who's written and directed by Emmy, Gotham, GLAAD, and Independent Spirit Award nominee, Tim Kirkman. You might know him from Dear Jesse and Loggerheads and The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me, and a lot of good work and good history there. But do you want to say anything about the title? I don't want to put you on the spot. I have other questions. It's just I love the title.
Well, I love the title too. I mean, it doesn't give anything away.
Exactly.
Me saying this, but I think the movie is a lot about how you see things as a metaphor, but also literally how you see your world.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, both of these characters, both my character I played, Dean, and Alex, the character that Aaron Costaganis plays, are both at a place in their lives where they're grappling with what they want their lives to be, what their lives have become.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really meet people at a cross.
Sure.
I'll say that.
Mm-hmm.
And how we interpret that, how we extrapolate it, how we see it is all part of what this movie is exploring.
Sure. Why, another one of my favorite questions for you and this film, why isn't Tell Me What You Want a simple question?
Do you think it's a simple question?
Absolutely not. And I have to say, one of the things that draws me to this film and made me happily anticipate this interview is that the dialogue is just so dead on. And that's one of those memorable moments, I feel. Tell me what you want. It's a simple question. And response?
The response is it's not a simple question. I think that Tim Kirkman he wrote such a lovely script. And, mm-hmm. and the first time I read it, I knew it was a project that I wanted to be a part of, because mm-hmm. I feel like it really captures these complicated moments in a relationship.
Yes.
I mean, tell me what you want. For me, Lucas, is such a terrifying question, just because I feel like I like to have all possibilities all the time.
Mm.
And the minute that I have to say exactly what it is that I want, I feel like I have to give something else up. But I think that one of the things that we're talking about in this film is getting to a point where you do kind of have to say, you know, what do I want my relationship to
mm-hmm.
be? What do I want my career to be?
Yeah.
And I think when you reach a certain age, this movie's about people in their early 40s who I think have hit a milestone moment where you go, okay, well, I'm not in my 20s anymore,
mm-hmm.
and I'm actually not in my 30s anymore,
right.
and I've made certain choices, and I've gone down certain paths, and I've built a career, or I've set my life up in a way that looks a certain way, and I think, you know, age does this, and sometimes big changes in life do this, but you reach these moments where you look back and take stock of everything, and sometimes it's not totally what you imagined it would be.
Exactly.
And that can be really scary, and it can be really it can cause crisis in your life. So Tell Me What You Want is, like, to me, I think that's like a really dangerous question
mm-hmm.
For someone who is going through that and trying to figure out what they want. And in the movie, without giving it away, in the movie, the answer is very, very complicated.
Yes. Indeed it is. You know, we've been sort of programmed to, especially as Americans, we've been programmed to believe that certain ages, you know, you turn 40, you turn 50, you turn 65, whatever, is supposed to bring with it a certain reality. And as you said, as you say, as Lucas, as well as Dean, those realities are really, preconceived by someone, you know, we don't even know, the people who decide, put it in a book somewhere, or poetry or whatever. What are your thoughts?
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that's really well put. I think it's really dangerous to start looking at things in terms of hitting milestones that are societal or cultural milestones, because
mm-hmm.
suddenly you can start feeling like you're not measuring up to some standard,
yes.
which, you know, is a dangerous thing, because you got to say, well, whose standard am I trying to live up to?
Exactly.
What is that idea? And is that actually something that brings me happiness or joy, or is that something that just is kind of a low-lying stress about keeping up with the Joneses, but
mm-hmm.
isn't actually anything I want to do? So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a trap that we all fall into, the shoulds and those timelines that exist out there for, we've all kind of agreed that those are the kind of things you're supposed to, you know, all the markers you're supposed to hit along the way, you know. You have, by a certain age, you have a house. By a certain age, you're married. By a certain age, know, you have a kid, and you start feeling bad if that's not happening. Right now, I'm like one of the few. I have a friend group here in Los Angeles, and I'm the only one who doesn't have a kid right now. And it hit me the other day. I was like, oh wow, I'm the only one of us who isn't supporting a child. It's me, I'm supporting myself.
Yes.
But you know, it's those moments are can be very revelatory, and you know, you have to answer the question. It's like, okay, well, do I want to have a kid? Do I want to be married, or what do I want that to actually look like? Because it can look like so many things, and people actually find so many different versions of that. That's what's always interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You have this idea that it all is kind of supposed to look a certain way, and marriage kind of works a certain way, but you get in and you start exploring people's relationships, and people have very creative solutions for relationships.
Yes.
And it often doesn't work. It's not as status quo sometimes as it looks from the outside.
Mm-hmm. And I think I don't know where you might have been going with what you said, but I would like to say there are clearly subtle differences on what those expected moments are chronologically, depending on gender, sex, race, sexual preference. I mean, it's just exact. And so I think 40 was easier for me because I had my crash, if you will, when I was 25. I 25 years old, I'd forgotten. I was busy. I'm busy working, I'm happy to say. I'd forgotten it was my birthday, and I get this call wishing me a happy birthday, and I suddenly realized I was a quarter of a century old and I had done nothing with my life. I really had a traumatic moment, and friends came over. They had done all kinds of things. Suddenly an impromptu party, and they told me, each of them, maybe a half dozen or more, how I had affected their life. And suddenly I realized, wow, I had been gauging, of course, being a quarter of a century, and by how much money I'd made and how much work I'd done, and here these people's lives had changed. So it made 40 a little easier for me, is the point. But back to... exactly. Back to Lazy Eyes. Cinematographer, for instance, is the Emmy Award-winning Gabe Mahan. And I wanted to mention that now and ask you, because I've only seen the trailer, but it is beautifully shot and beautiful.
Yeah,
and I guess we should say it's a weekend at a vacation house in the desert, but that isn't
the Joshua Tree.
Exactly. So tell us about location shooting and about, I guess, how do you deal with being 99% of the film?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad you brought up Gabe, because he really did such amazing things with the desert in this film. I mean, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautifully, beautifully shot. The cinematography is just gorgeous.
Yes.
And of course, the desert, about 3 hours outside of Los Angeles, and you're in, it almost seems like a lunar landscape out there.
Mm.
It's really a spectacular place to be. And so that in itself was just an incredible experience, and kind of added it's like a whole character in the movie.
Yes.
The desert and this landscape, and this town that we shot in has a lot of history to it, and it keeps popping up in the film in fun ways.
Mm-hmm.
What was the other part of that question?
The other question was you.
Oh no! I also want to say that this movie was shot in 12 days.
Wow.
Which is, if you've ever made a film before, that's like really, really fast.
Yes.
And we shot most of those days in the desert, and then we shot a few days back in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So we were. It was a very fast shoot, but it's a real testament to the producers, Tutshots, our producer, and Tim and Gabe, that and everyone involved in the crew, that it was so smooth. And I don't know how they did it, but they really created an environment that felt very collaborative and also ran really efficiently. So those guys worked some serious magic and allowed this to be a very organic process, which for me and for Aaron Costaganis, I think that was, I can't speak for him, but I know that for me that was a really welcome environment to come into, because my background is in the theater. I've done a lot of theater mostly in New York, and so this is the biggest film role that I've ever had, and it was a real challenge in a lot of ways, but one of the most challenging parts of it was finding the process that is different for film than it is for theater.
Yes.
And when things move so quickly and you don't have 3 weeks of rehearsal to go and try things and kind of, you know, collaborate on what these moments are and develop things in a room together, you kind of have to work much quicker in front of the camera, and you know, we would do three takes and then we'd move on.
That's
so that was a real challenge, but it was made easier by the fact that there was a great sense of collaboration on set. And we did get about a week and a half of rehearsal, 2 weeks of rehearsal, the three of us, Tim and Aaron and I, before we started shooting. So we were able to plant some seeds in the development process that we could refer back to conversations we had had and scenes that we had kind of fussed with while we were shooting, and had like a shorthand to move forward during the shoot, which was nice. It was a real interesting experience working that way, because you kind of have to get out of your own way.
Yes.
There isn't a whole lot of time to sit and mull things over. And for me, my goal as an actor in that situation, just to keep myself from becoming totally overwhelmed with the weight of the thing, and with being in almost every shot and not really having time to go off and do my own thing, just to be present. I said, okay, well, if I can just be present and remember that, like, this is a human being, and the situation, which was so relatable to me, which made it easier, this situation is real, and give myself over to that. And that just became my goal. Every take was to just invest in the situation and not overthink it, and try to speak like a human being.
Yes.
And it was great. I mean, it was a great, just a completely invaluable experience to do that. Because sometimes when you are given those constraints, and you can't overthink something, it actually allows you to get to something very simple and basic. And so Aaron and I just, I think we just were trying to just talk to each other.
Exactly.
And really talk through this very real situation and see where that led us. And it took a lot of trust in Tim. I think Tim had to trust us a lot, and we had to trust him, and we did. I mean, we found a way to really go there with each other and be open to how things were going to shift throughout the course of the shoot.
Excellent. We're going to go to break soon. I want to remind everyone we're talking about Lazy Eye, the film that's going to be released theatrically in November 2016. I'm talking with its star, who plays Dean, Lucas Nieuwerbrugge.
And
I tried so hard. I had to try to say it one more time at least. But thank you for being patient with me, Lucas. And Lucas plays Dean in Lazy Eye, with Aaron Costaganis as well playing Alex. And we're going to talk more about his transition from theater to film, as that's a transition I've been through, mostly from theater to soap operas. But as you talk about not having much opportunity to overthink it, I want to talk about that a little more and remind it. My original question was, and you got to it, Lucas, what's it like being 99% of the film? We'll talk about that and other things when we come back in our next segment with Lucas. And, of course, Lazy Eye was directed by Tim Kirkman. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. The world fell in love with dolphins when Flipper was such a TV star in the 1960s. Intelligent creatures, and look, he'll pull you through the waves if you hang on his fin. Charming, and ultimately deadly to the world's dolphin population. Rick O'Berry was Flipper's trainer. He eventually came to believe that interference with these intelligent creatures was unacceptable. In 2007, he led a group of environmental activists on a dangerous mission to infiltrate a secret cove near Taiji in Japan, site of an annual dolphin slaughter. Using underwater cameras and microphones, the crew was constantly threatened by guards determined to keep the slaughter a secret. An annual dolphin migration is the target of the Taiji fishermen who herd them into the cove, where they are trapped and brutally slaughtered, saving only a few for sale to aquariums and tourist dolphin swims. The cove turns red with the blood of thousands of marine mammals. The air is filled with their screams. The cove horrified audiences around the world, but the needless slaughter continues despite the efforts of O'Berry and thousands of others to stop it. Think that swimming with captured dolphins is a harmless way to enjoy nature? Think again. Indie Film Minute, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Talk Radio Show. My guest today is Lucas Nieuwerbrugge. And Lucas plays Dean, who is a graphic designer in Los Angeles, who reconnects with Alex, played by Aaron Costaganis, an ex-boyfriend he hasn't seen or heard from in 15 years. However, as I said before, this is not a simple weekend in the country. There are many layers, and although Lucas was sharing how there wasn't time to overthink it, nonetheless, the story is full of subplot and layers and in-depth performances. Directed by Tim Kirkman, and also mentioning the cinematographer again, Emmy Award-winning Gabe Mahan, because the visuals are magnificent. So, Lucas, we're back, and I just wanted to revisit. I know we talked, you hit it, what is it like to be 99% of the film, but part of that also is that you play an older and younger version of you, yes?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that.
It was a great challenge. I mean, as an actor, I think that that's one of the great things that we get to do is explore, you know, future, past versions of ourselves in some way. And that was a great thing in the script, was that you have scenes that happened like 15 years ago and scenes. I should say that Tim wrote characters who exist in their 40s and then in their 20s.
Yes.
So he made the decision to, instead of casting two different actors for each character, I always find that a little bit, there's always a suspension of disbelief you have to make when you see someone else playing the same character, you know, 10 years before or something. Mm-hmm. So he said, well, I want to find two actors who can play both ages, believably. Wow. So Aaron and I are both in our 30s, and they aged us up with a little bit of makeup and are acting to be in our 40s, and then aged us down to be in our 20s, which was a lot of fun.
Yes.
So we got, you know, we got to have scenes of in our flashbacks where we are, you know, in a stage of first meeting each other and first love and very kind of exciting and energy, and then the bulk of the movie happens where we are in our 40s and dealing with what the past was, mm-hmm. and what it means to us now. So that was great. I mean, I personally love that, those kind of opportunities to say, okay, well, what does it mean to be in your 40s versus being in your 30s? Like, what is that headspace? And kind of what we were talking about earlier, a lot of that also has to do with the pressure you put on yourself and the expectations that we all have for ourselves, be it our own personal goals or what we believe society expects us to be doing at a certain age, mm-hmm. And what that does to our choices. I'm very interested in what it means to be looking at your work as an artist as you get older, mm-hmm. In terms of how you've shaped a career in the arts. And Dean is a graphic designer, and he is someone who I think had a specific idea of the way that his art was going to manifest itself. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting part of this film, which is the conversation about, you know, what happens when a career in the arts ends up not being either as romantic as you thought it was going to be, or when you have to make decisions that are based on paying the rent versus doing work that is purely feeds your artistic soul and really says something. Mm-hmm. And that's something I struggle with all the time, trying to find projects that A, just keep me working, but also projects that feed me, that make me feel like I'm actually contributing to the conversation in our world, mm-hmm. and that I'm saying something relevant, and that I'm saying something that I actually believe in and that I'm mm-hmm. passionate about. And I think it's a constant balancing act that we all perform as artists to find how you do both things. Because if you just do it for the money and you're never really aligned with what is being said in mm-hmm. the work that you're doing, but you're getting paid a lot, I think that can be really depressing.
Yes.
And I think that you can find that I know people who have done that for a long time, and then all of a sudden it's like the clouds clear and they go, holy moly, like, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. I feel like I've been doing my art, but I'm so disconnected from the actual work. Mm. And I think that's a scary thing. If you consider yourself an artist, I think that can be a scary moment when you're not in tune with the work mm-hmm. that you're doing.
And you know, with that in mind, Lazy Eye is, people might think they know what it's about before they go, but I think it has well, let's put it this way. Years ago, when I lived in New York, I was rehearsing in Manhattan Theater, and in the same theater, Terrence McNally was rehearsing Love, Valor, Compassion, before it opened off Broadway and, you know, then went on to Broadway. And because I was there and around and, you know, bumping into people in the hallway, etc., I got invited to the opening, and I mentioned it to a lady friend of mine who was ecstatic about going. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I didn't think it was going to be my cup of tea. But it was a play that within 30 seconds, I realized that I didn't know at all what to expect, and that this was real, it was universal. But I think Lazy Eye goes even further. It doesn't just erase stereotypes. I mean, it does that, but it really gets to the core of why, like you say, why do we do what we do? Why do we, whether as an artist or as a human being, how, if I'm anywhere close to the target there for a question, how do you feel about that? How did, the issue was not, I guess I'm trying to say, the issue was not sexual preference. The issue was, go ahead, you tell us.
Yeah, no, I think you're right on about that. And that's, I love that about this film, and that's part of what drew me to this film to begin with, was that, you know, the characters in the film are both gay, but it's not a story about that.
Exactly.
That is not what it's about. It's about two human beings, and it's a very universal story, and it's about life stuff. I mean, it's about grappling with big life stuff, and within that, it kind of is about everything.
Yes.
In a way. I mean, it may sound very pretentious, but it's about like existence, and I think that's a nice place. To me, I'm excited about arriving there in terms of the stories that we tell, in terms of how we see gay characters portrayed in the media, and trans characters portrayed in the media, and the whole LGBT community is just part of our fabric as a society, and there are so many different stories within that, and some of them do have to do with finding that identity, and others have to do with just telling good stories. And I think that it's really nice to see those stories where the main focus isn't about finding your sexuality, but someone's sexuality is just a part of the texture of the film.
Yes.
As much as, you know, you watch a movie about a heterosexual couple, and it doesn't have to be about whether they're straight or gay. That just kind of factors in and becomes part of the overall story. So that I'm very excited by that, and I'm glad that you brought it up, because I think that that's something that is special about this movie.
Well, I have to say, again, in watching the trailer, beautifully shot, performed, and my feeling immediately was, oh my God, this is what all of us have to go through, something like this in our life. And how we come out on the other side, whether it's together or not, is a life lesson. And is a part of life that everyone is affected by at some point or another. And it really has very little to do. I mean, it could, as you say, it could be about one's sexual orientation or political leanings or, you know, secret history or whatever. But it really, Lazy Eye is about two people recapturing something, to be sure, but it's even more than that. Tell us about that. I mean, it goes beyond, I haven't seen you in a long time. What have you been up to?
It actually jumps right into the thick of it.
Yes.
As I feel like those relationships happen that way. That when you reconnect with someone that you've had a powerful or meaningful connection with, you sometimes skip past a lot of the superficialities of reconnecting, and you jump right into kind of where you left off.
Exactly.
Which can also be really confusing. I mean, I reconnected with someone that was just totally in love with in high school, and this is like 15 years later. I'm talking about my real life, and we ran into each other again, and it was so loaded for me in a way that was totally unexpected. And you know, you're kind of playing this parallel narrative of being an adolescent and this kind of hormonal, like all my memories of this person were just drenched in hormones. There's part of me that's like, I'm so thankful that I can see things in a clearer way now. But like, my memories at that time are really so vivid and really like stamped on me, because it happened at a certain time in my life, and because it was like the first time that I was going through all that stuff. And that, I mean, memories can be a real bitch. Honestly, I think that it can get you into a lot of trouble, because you sit with your memories, and I think they change over time, and they get cast in a certain way over time, and you begin to attach to them over and over again as you change, mm-hmm. but you're attaching to something that happened a long time ago and that happened under a certain context. And it can be dangerous to... I think it can be dangerous territory to revisit those memories without having a certain amount of context to it.
Sure. And you know, that gets back to Lazy Eye, too, because the two characters, Dean, who you play, and Alex, that Aaron plays,
yeah.
they also have, it may not be the crux of the film, but there is at least a moment where they admit to one another or realize they don't have the same memory of...
No.
Exactly. Tell us.
No. They remember the same experience in completely different ways.
Yes.
It happens over and over again. And I think that's so true to my experience, at
mm-hmm.
least.
It's true in life.
You know, you can be reminiscing with someone, and you were both there. You both experienced the exact same event together, and yet your recollection of it can be two completely different stories.
Mm.
So, I don't know. There's a lesson in there somewhere, maybe about taking it with a grain of salt or
yes.
it's all relative or something. But yeah, that's a big part of the film, for sure.
And I want to mention just a personal story. I am still best friends of a guy who has been happily married since I met him practically, and I the same
mm-hmm.
way. But we hadn't seen each other in... a decade. I went to New York, he went to California, and we've mm-hmm. met again in D.C. after maybe 10 or 15 years, and the conversation started as though we had just talked on the telephone the day before. And
yeah.
and that, in many ways, despite the recollection differences between Alex and Dean, in many ways, that's what Lazy Eye shows us, yes?
Yes, absolutely. That's a big theme in the movie.
Just like it never, there never was an interruption. It's just a continuation of the conversation. And yet you're 20 years older or 15 years older at least, yes?
Yeah, 15 years later, you know, and your life has gone in opposite directions.
Mm, mm-hmm.
I think that there's always a sense in those moments of playing out, of going into the fantasy.
Yes.
And of playing out the fantasy of, well, what would have happened
yes.
if...
Yes, yes.
Would I be happier if I had just stayed with this person?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a dangerous place to go with relationships because... There was a reason you got out of there in the first place.
Yes. Which we sometimes forget, you know, right?
Yes. And there's, you know, it's a little bit more complicated in the film, and
yes.
I won't give it away because
yes.
their relationship has a nuanced twist to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it can be it can set off a lot of different signals when you
mm-hmm.
reconnect with someone like that.
Exactly. Well, let's remind people, especially if we haven't mentioned, Lazy Eye will premiere in New York at New Fest, and has also been in Frameline, Provincetown International Film Festival. It will be released theatrically in November 2016.
November 11th.
November 11th.
New York and L.A.
Very
and
good.
And will be available online November 15th. That's video on demand, Amazon, and iTunes.
Very
and
good.
That, all that good stuff.
Thank you, Lucas, for throwing that in.
Yeah. Thank you.
And yeah, and it is written and directed by Emmy, Gotham, GLAAD, and Independent Spirit Award nominee Tim Kirkman, who you may remember was his work with Dear Jesse and Loggerheads, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me. So we've been talking with the star of Lazy Eye, Lucas Nieuwerbrugge, who plays, I know, I'm so pleased with myself.
I know, I feel like I won want to give you an award every time you say that so well. It's
well,
really impressive.
You know, I was under a little pressure. I put myself under pressure about it, Lucas, because my name, I don't think, is as complicated, especially if you see it spelled. It's Marcello Rolando, and people really butcher it. And I said, well, doggone it, I'm not going to do this to Lucas. Lucas, it has been an exceptional conversation about Lazy Eye and all the great work of cinematographer, Emmy Award-winning Gabe Mayen, and director-writer Tim Kirkman, and your performances with Aaron Costaganis and you, Lucas. So I truly recommend Lazy Eye. Don't say that about everything. It is a movie about people, the universal arc that we must all travel. Is there any other contact information or Facebook information that you want to give us, Lucas, about how we can find you guys, so we can get tickets, or just anything you want to say?
Yeah, well, you can check out the website, which I believe is lazyeyemovie.com.
Okay.
And there's all kinds of information on there. You can watch our trailer there as well. And look out for us in theaters in New York and Los Angeles, November 11th. And find us on video on demand on November 15th.
Oh, wow.
And check out our film.
Excellent.
And
thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcello Rolando, for having me on.
I know why you said my full name. It's been a pleasure talking to you, too. All the best.
Yeah.
Truly, Lucas. It's been fabulous.
Too.
Bye now.
Okay, take care.
You
Bye.
Too. Bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
Now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Back in 2005, Hustle and Flow hit the Sundance Film Festival and exploded into that year's must-see film in the mountains of Utah. However, the story unfolds a million miles away from that idle setting, in the tough inner city of Memphis, Tennessee. But this is no shallow ghetto story. Yes, its central character is a pimp, but from the opening frame, we know that DJ, played with depth and nuance by Terrence Howard, has an intellectual core. We can't help but believe that born in a different environment, he would have found success in any number of respectable fields. But in his real world, he must choose from the avenues available to him. And he must dream the impossible dream, a ticket out through his art. Fortunately, DJ has the magic to inspire a disparate group of friends to join in pursuing his dream to create a rap anthem. Will DJ, with a bunch of whores singing back up, a quirky white boy with recording skills, and a church-going family man ultimately succeed? Hustle and Flow is a gripping film about the American dream, full of complexity and a richness of vision that will burn its story and its song into that special corner where we hold the films we love. Hustle and Flow, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. In the good old days before Hillary's emails, the terrorists against democracy's liberty and justice for all aren't ignoring the writing on the wall. They've just been quietly switching walls, from coal ash mountain topping to falling oil prices, fracking water to cracking gas pipelines, ramrodding Dakota protesters to corporate private prison collaborations. The Alec G's stands alone, almost. Perhaps numbed by law and order Nixon, war on drugs Reagan, tough on crime Bush Sr., three strikes and you're out Clinton, we've evolved to the lawlessness and disorder of political rallies inciting violence against differences of opinion. Truth is, we're in a time warped by Jim Crow reruns. Super predators don't dwell in a Trumped ghetto, but are money changers bankrupting our future while undecided pendulums reactively swing rather than voting for choice. Wells Fargo, militarized police, war on women, Native Americans, and LGBTQ communities are individual choices. No one has to be a conservative woman for a misogynistic president. We can choose to shine our rocket's red glare to save the abused spouse, raped neighbor, kidnapped child, and the missing of the killing season. Conservatives simultaneously running from and with an ALEC, transitioning, choosing to minimize expenses incurred rooming and boarding up minorities, and taking its show on the road with GPS monitoring anklets. So, believing corporate media deflecting hasn't infected social media anonymity, we get bought and sold unaware we've been flogged into isolationism. But if baby boomers embrace Generation X texting to millennials on Instagram, we might hold the line, November 8th, 2016. Just imagine baby boomers and millennials centered by Generation X. What couldn't we do to end the herding of our better selves by alt-right trolls self-perpetuating a distorted nightmare of our American dream with do-over pale-face extremes? Whether united we stand or stronger together, America is at its greatest when Americans stand together for community, committed to civility, neighborhoods of every color, and a multicultural world determined to save the earth and all life upon it. The better choice? Showing up decisively for harmonious dissolving derision, knowing there is no security, independence, nor greatness in divorcing the good fight, reneging on the promise of Lady Liberty, or pretending our individual lives are the only life experience for all of we the people. We don't have to submit to the inheritance from those who tarnish the very ideal of exceptionalism, which is being special, not superior. Our real power on earth is gathering together for peace and harmony, regardless of skin color, heritage, gender, sexual preference, or political persuasion. However, truth itself can dissipate in the creation of discriminatory labels that taint all of us with lies of convenience told by the few, but once accepted, redefining the core of too many. Painful truth. Our Constitution allows slavery in the form of mass incarceration, gender inequality, and the income disparity of prison labor on the public tab, benefiting private enterprise. Unlike 1930s Europe, we needn't goose-step behind the loudest and latest voices. We have the power to make candidates follow our lead, for what the elected crave even more than Supremes guaranteeing Citizens United is our vote. Imagine escaping bottom-line marketing labels, factory farms, and Lee Atwater's campaign code words cueing conservatives for Nixon and Reagan racial discrimination, Clinton's SWAT police forces, Bush-Cheney black sites, and Guantanamo torturing our souls into GOP's birther Tea Party bigots, and their don. Russian hackers, computer technology, and greed are not waiting, only transitioning, while we're still busy arguing over emails and which came first, trumped conservative chickens or the egg laid by the FBI. We can make prisons to go with Jerry Watson's American Bail Coalition and block the vote with Paul Weyrich, going right back to the good old days of Donald Trump. Or we can vote out of many. 1. The truth that sets us free stings. Not all of us want equality and justice for all, but Lincoln's new birth of freedom affirms voting of, by, and for all the people is both individual privilege and national responsibility, if we can keep it. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of thereasonablevoice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.